Thank you all for that response. I'm going to ask a follow-up on this, so we'll go in the same order and 30 seconds for it. Dr. Gill was the only one who mentioned military spending, which is a popular thing for Democrats to mention. But none of you mentioned what Republicans claim is a key driver in the deficit, and that's entitlement reform. They claim it's the largest portion of the deficit. You may disagree with that, but certainly you're going to have to address changes in the entitlement structure to get to zero on a deficit, and I'd like you to address that. And we'll start with Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Sure. Well, there are a couple things that we can do to increase funds. We can raise the Social Security cap. We also, in the tax bill, they just got rid of the corporate alternative minimum tax. We can put that back in. In terms of the federal programs, Medicare is transforming right now. They are bringing their costs down through these shared savings programs and through these accountable care organizations. Let's look at programs that work in reining in our federal spending, like these programs in place now. Let's bring in Medicaid into that mix, and let's see what we can do. We cannot cut Medicare and Medicaid or Social Security, no.
Jonathan Ebel.
I guess I disagree with the premise of the question, which is that a zeroed out deficit is the goal that we should be striving for. I like a balanced checkbook like anybody, but I also believe that we as a nation have a responsibility to each other to maintain a robust safety net, social safety net. And right now, Medicare, Medicaid, SNAP benefits, Social Security are holding people up who desperately need that. So if we're looking to reform our budget, those are not places that I would look.
David Gill.
You know, I disagree with the use of the term entitlements, Charlie. Those are not entitlements. Those are things that people have earned. When you look at your paycheck that you get every week or two or month, people have put money into that anticipating that they're funding their future health care or their future retirement. And so if there's any changing to be done, I think it's in preserving and strengthening those programs, not privatizing them, not raising retirement age.
Eric Jones.
I agree. I was going to say the same thing on entitlement. I think that's the wrong word to be using. I think it implies that this is something people are just being given, and it's not. Social Security is something that we're all putting into and we're all earning as we speak. You know, I think the problem that we're facing here is that the Republican Party has put forward a $1 trillion tax cut. And they've done it before, and they've just done it again, and they're going to use it as an excuse to try to cut back Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, and we have to fight against it. And you know, in the Bush administration, we went to a war with Iraq right after a tax cut and spent $1 trillion there, and I think we can be using our money better.
And Angel Sides.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know really what to say for that either. I'm sure there are some places to save money, but I just think it's propaganda, and even the term entitlement reform, that's not the way to balance the budget.
This is Sound Ideas. You're listening to a congressional candidates forum for the Democratic Party in the 13th Congressional District at the Normal Theater in Uptown. Catherine Tang of Collinsville asks, what specific action do the candidates intend to take in order to address the terrible phenomenon of mass shootings? And we start with Mr. Ebel.
Yes. So on the issue of gun violence prevention, I teach at the University of Illinois, as I mentioned, and a good size class at the U of I is 90 students. We lose 90 Americans every day, an entire classroom of students at the U of I, to gun violence. Two-thirds of those, about 60, are self-inflicted gunshot wounds or suicides. So the mass shootings are obviously an important thing. They're horrible when they happen, but they are a part of a much larger culture of violence that we need to address as a public health crisis, and that I think will give itself up to a couple of kinds of solutions. On the mass shootings, as the questioner asked, I think we need to institute background checks for mandatory background checks for weapons purchases and ammunitions purchases, and do everything we can to keep firearms out of the hands of those with a history of mental health problems, domestic abuse, and as it turns out, animal abuse as well. I think two, that I'll turn, I see I have 30 seconds, I'll turn to the question of suicide. We do need to do a far better job of educating people about the really dangerous intersection of mental health problems or chronic clinical depression and the presence of guns in a home. That is the leading cause of gun violence death in America, and it is something that is through education and through letting people know that although the Second Amendment is the law of the land, it does not have to be the law of your household. That if someone is suffering from clinical depression, you should take the gun
very
away.
Much. Thank you. Dr. Gill.
I appreciate the question. Working in the emergency department, gun violence is something that touches me at a very personal level. I see far too many victims on a far too regular basis, and it leaves me passionate with regards to instituting some reforms so that we don't see these types of mass shootings or less than mass shootings, you know, simple things that 80 to 90% of the American public agrees on, but that we don't see because of the dominance of the NRA special interest getting money into the pockets of our congresspeople. Things like mandatory background checks on every gun purchased and limiting the number of rounds per magazine to 10 or less. That's the only issue that you'll ever hear me agreeing with Dick Cheney on. And the banning of the bump stocks that we saw featured in that Las Vegas massacre, I thought that surely here was a time where Congress could find the bravery in their hearts to stand up and do something shortly after that Las Vegas incident. But no, the NRA is that powerful. And I think what Professor Ebel says is very important. I also spend upwards of a quarter of my day in the ER dealing with mental health situations. And the way that our current healthcare system deals with mental health devalues people, dehumanizes them, demonizes people that have mental health issues. And when we have a single-payer healthcare system, we'll be able to treat mental health in the same vigorous way in which we do physical health and do much better with regards to that.
Eric Jones, your turn.
I think there are steps that we could be taking as a country immediately that most Americans agree on to stem the problem with gun violence in this country. First off, everyone should get a background check before they buy a gun. And right now, as it stands, criminals, domestic terrorists, people who've been convicted of domestic abuse can go out and buy a gun in this country, and that is unacceptable. We also still allow bump stocks to be purchased, even though we saw what happened following the Las Vegas shooting. And then finally, even though we've seen mass shootings over and over and over again, what has Congress been working on? They've been working on a reciprocity bill. For those of you who don't know what that is, they want to allow anybody who has a concealed carry license in anywhere in the country, it should apply in any state, which would take away Illinois' right to determine how Illinois has its concealed carry law. And that's unacceptable. And on every one of these issues, the reason why that's the bill they're pushing in reciprocity, or the reason why they haven't banned bump stocks, or the reason why they haven't done a background check is because of the gun lobby in Washington. And that's the challenge that we're facing over and over and over again on all these issues, whether it's on climate change or whether it's on health care reform or whether it's on getting a tax system that's actually fair to the middle class and not doing favors for the super rich. It's a special interest in Washington that we're fighting against. That's what I've been fighting throughout my career, and that's what I'm going to go to Washington to do.
And Angel Sides, your take on this.
Yeah, I'm doing my political commentary and editing and splicing and dicing different excerpts of documentaries. There seems to be a lot of information out there that has a link between psychotropic drugs, painkillers, and some of these mass shootings. If you look at the people who actually were engaged in these mass shootings. So I think we really need to, it kind of goes back to campaign finance reform, because Big Pharma is the biggest lobbyist of Congress, and supposedly Eli Lilly knew that they were putting a drug on the market that caused violence, and they're doing this just for the fact that even though they're going to be sued, they factor that in, they can still make a lot more money putting a dangerous drug on the market. So that should be discussed along with the gun issue when we have all these mass shootings. I think we need a voluntary trade-in of semi-automatic weapons for maybe half the cost of what the gun is worth, and we need to end privatized sales of guns.
And Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Thank you. I agree with my colleagues that we need universal unified federal background checks. And I am against the concealed carry reciprocity. We have very specific laws in Illinois about who can and can't carry a concealed weapon. And what this does is we require in Illinois for anybody to carry a concealed weapon, they have to have 16 hours of actual live training. That's what we've determined. This law takes that away from us, and it says the people from Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa, who don't have to have any training in live fire training, if they have a concealed carry license, they can bring their gun into our state. I disagree with that. I would also like to see us, in order to address these mass shootings and the gun violence in our communities, we need to have the Center for Disease Control do what it, at one time, it was allowed to do and then has been disallowed to do by the United States government, and that is to study gun violence as the public health crisis that it is. Drill down on the root causes and give us some actionable steps to cure this disease of gun violence in our communities.
You're listening to Special Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, Bloomington Normal's public media, a Democratic congressional candidate forum for the 13th District at the Normal Theater. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Our candidates are Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, Jonathan Ebel, David Gill, Eric Jones, and Angel Sides. There has been a deadlock in Congress for many years now on infrastructure renewal. Part of the deadlock has been the inability to come up with a funding mix, whether that is a gas tax increase, a tax on miles driven, allocation for other revenue sources, or whatnot. What is your sweet spot for a funding mix you believe will get bipartisan buy-in for an infrastructure bill? And let us start with David Gill.
The need for infrastructure reform in this country is urgent, and we see it right here in Illinois 13 with deteriorating bridges and roadways, the lack of broadband access in large parts of this congressional district, and it extends nationwide as well, the need. And the funding is there. I say all the time that when we talk about a wide variety of issues in campaigns such as this, that it's a question of reordering our priorities. You know, why we insist on engaging in endless warfare. I was out there, probably a lot of the people in this auditorium were out there in very early 2003 saying, don't invade Iraq. And we lost the people that argued against it. We went in there. And the money that we wasted, the trillions of dollars because of that invasion and the consequences of that invasion, could have been used to pay for infrastructure repair many times over. Could have been used for 50 to 100 years of free college for everybody that wanted to go to college. And so the resources are there, Charlie. If we stop engaging in endless war and pandering to the arms manufacturers and the oil industry, and instead turn to things like Green Revolution that I was mentioning before, there are so many jobs to be had in putting solar panels on all of the roofs here in Illinois 13. Again, when we have our priorities in order, when we have representatives that are not funded by corporate America, we'll do the right thing.
Eric Jones.
I agree that it is a matter of priority. We are the wealthiest country in the world, and if we want to invest in infrastructure in this country, we have the resources to do it, and we just need to do it. And I think sometimes we forget that we've done big things in this country before. In the 1930s, half of this country did not have electricity. We had a rural electrification problem. The Roosevelt administration stepped forward, created the REA and the electric co-op system, and now we take for granted that everyone in this country has access to electricity. In the 1950s, we started the interstate system under President Eisenhower, a Republican, and invested heavily in that interstate system, which has been a big driver of the economy that we now have. And what we're facing right now is we have roads that are falling apart, we have bridges that are becoming more dangerous, and we have too many people in this country who do not have access to basic high-speed internet. You know, I pulled the numbers from the Federal Communications Commission, and in the 13th District alone, in the counties that make up the district, over 200,000 people do not have access to basic high-speed internet. And when I say don't have access, I mean they can't get it if they want it. And a lot of them don't have access to cell phone service where they live either. And I speak from this from personal perspective. My in-laws live in Wayne County, Illinois, in Fairfield, and they live just right outside of town. And when I would go work there, they have no access to the internet. And so when I would work, I would have to go sit either in the lobby of McDonald's or sometimes in the parking lot to get access to their Wi-Fi. And there are too many people in this country that are doing that. There are students that are doing that. And in order for us to have an economy that's working in every zip code, we have to invest in our infrastructure, and that means rural broadband.
Angel Sides.
Yeah, I think a good way to save money on our infrastructure and even make money for any given city would be solar roads. I've been in contact with Scott and Julie Broussard, and they have roads that actually melt the snow, which would save money in the long term with, you know, like plowing snow or putting salt on the roads. They supply a city with three times the electricity it needs if every road, sidewalk, and parking lot were paved. Therefore, eventually, houses could be electrically heated. They're kind of neat. They tuck electrical lines under the road so they're more accessible. They detect animals on the road, and so that could save lives in the long run. And you can change the pattern of, let's say, a parking lot after hours from a parking lot to maybe a basketball court, and kids can play basketball or hopscotch. So they're computers, and there's panels that if something were to break could be taken up and just replace a panel instead of having to continually repave or replace the road itself. So I think as roads need to be replaced anyway or need to be repaved, they should be replaced with solar roads, and the same with federal buildings like rooftops. They could be replaced with solar roofs and have solar panels. And
Thank you very much. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, infrastructure and unlocking the deadlock on it.
You know, we have to look at it differently than we're looking at what they just did with the tax bill and creating a larger deficit. We can't look at it like that's just the deficit, just that's money that's going to corporations and the wealthiest 1%. Infrastructure, on the other hand, is an investment that we are making in ourselves and in our local communities. Whether it's modernizing our roads and bridges, or it is fixing the leaky pipes that are leaching mercury and arsenic into waterways, or it's improving our waterway system so our Illinois farmers can move their product along the river, or it's improving the electrical grid and making sure that people in every part of the district are able to turn their lights on and save money at the same time. This is an investment we are making in ourselves. It will create jobs, and when it creates the jobs, the money goes right back into our local communities. That means more local businesses. It means more disposable income for restaurants and for Main Street. That's what we want. So we have to look at it with a different perspective. We have to look at it as an investment in our future. And in terms of rural broadband, we have to connect our rural communities. I was visiting with business owners in Elsa, Illinois, who have beautiful forests and bald eagle sightings and are struggling to get people to their beds and breakfast because they can't get the word out because they are on dial-up or their cell phones don't work. We can fix that with an investment in ourselves.
And Jonathan Ebel.
Yeah. So in early 2003, that's actually when that phone call came from my commanding officer with my mobilization orders. And I bring that up now because I think that where we are failing as a country has something to do with priorities, but it also has something to do with bipartisan cooperation. There's nobody who loves a pothole, right? Nobody who just looks for that moment of intermittent cell phone service and cherishes it when it happens. We agree on the need for good infrastructure. We aren't able to get it done because of the amount of bipartisan mistrust in Congress and the way in which that has been cultivated. So I was happy last month to receive the endorsement of a group called With Honor. It is a group of veterans who are supporting veterans running for Congress. And the idea is that by getting people into Congress who have the shared experience, the shared lived by partisanship of military service, you're providing some sort of foundation for cooperation and for a functional Congress going forward. I would love to be a part of a Veterans Caucus that is out making that argument that we need to make this investment in infrastructure from broadband to sidewalks because it benefits all of us, and we on both sides of the aisle can agree on that.
You all very nobly talked about the need for infrastructure and the various ways in which it might happen and the kinds of infrastructure that are needed, but the sense of the question was about a funding mix that will prove bipartisan, that will have some bipartisan attraction, whether that's a gas tax increase for the first time in a long time, or miles driven, or some other form of revenue. And to it's not just an investment on the Republican side, so you're going to have to address what Republicans might like and sign on to in this follow-up question, which will be 30 seconds. And let's take it from the top again with David Gill starting about funding and what might prove saleable in Congress.
Well, I think that ultimately if Republican representatives will respond to ordinary people that would like to see a single-payer healthcare system in place, immediately you save $1 trillion, Charlie, and I don't know what your cost estimate is for the infrastructure repair that you're talking about, but I think that gives you a great big head start toward being able to put in place the types of repairs that we've been talking about for the last several minutes.
Eric Jones?
Well, I guess I would just take a point with the premise of the question, which is I'm running for Congress to replace a Republican who I don't think believes is doing the right thing on infrastructure. And I think what we need is a Congress that's composed of Democrats and Republicans who believe in infrastructure spending. And I will tell you, if you look at what Donald Trump did in 2016, Donald Trump ran on investment in infrastructure. That's all he talked about. Other than, well, there's some other things too, but he talked a lot about that. And what has he done on it? Nothing. So I actually think the American people do want an investment in infrastructure, and I think they're ready to do it in the normal way we've been funding the government for years.
Angel Sides, how to pay for it.
Well, I mean, I kind of just said, like, the solar roads, I think, I mean, it just seems like we're stuck in, you know, this fossil fuel administration and the Secretary of State's an oil man, but you would think if, you know, the funding would save, you know, every city, every community money, because in the long run, you're not having to replace roads all the time. You're not really having to plow the roads, and it actually provides every city with three times the electricity it needs, and that's money too. So they definitely pay for themselves.
Alrighty, thank you, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
I agree. We need to change the representation. We have to change the people in the room who are making the decisions. Part of that should be revisiting the tax bill. And it means putting the corporate alternative minimum tax back in place. Because all it did was pull the floor out from corporations. So it's a race to the bottom, and we took the floor out so it can just keep going. There is a minimum tax that corporations should have to pay for the privilege of business in the United States.
Jonathan Ebel?
Currently, earned income is taxed at roughly twice the rate of unearned income, the income that people make sitting back in their big comfy chairs watching their stock portfolios grow. Let's tax unearned income at the same rate as earned income, and we will be able to pay for roads and sidewalks and bridges and airports and broadband and everything else that everybody wants from now and into the future.
All righty. Thank you all very much for that, those answers to the follow-up. There are many permutations of a possible way forward for deferred action for childhood arrivals or DACA recipients. Clean DACA, DACA and wall funding linked, the McCain-Coons bill, which looks at DACA and a broader border security strategy, but not a wall in particular. Those are just a few. Where do you gauge the compromise is most ripe to happen between Democrats, the Trump administration, and congressional Republicans who can support a way forward on this issue? And let's start with Mr. Jones.
Well, first I'll say, let me be clear on where I stand on this issue of the Dreamers or DACA or DACA. The United States government made a promise to these people, to the children and the who came forward and said, I'm going to let you know who I am, and we're going to work together because the United States government made a promise. And now that promise is being used against them. They stepped forward, and now the United States government has fallen back on the promise that they would allow the path to citizenship over time. We have to get this done. It's a moral imperative, and I think we have to work on how that's going to get done. You know, I saw that there was a recent government shutdown over it. There was then a three-week spending bill. I think the Democrats need to hold strong on this issue and need to continue pushing this, and so we can get the Dreamers to have the rights that they were promised. I'm very concerned, frankly. I'll tell you, it appears that Donald Trump isn't interested in getting this done, and it appears that the Republicans in the House are not interested in getting this done. The good news is the Senate Democrats have a role to play here, and I'm very hopeful that eventually there will be a compromise that comes forward. And we still have just a little bit of time. The sort of deadline that's really going to matter is in March, and I'm very hopeful that something will get done before then, but I have been concerned about it.
Angel Sides.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like nothing will get done with this either, but what people don't know is the DACA recipients, they don't really use any federal money. They don't have any handouts. They don't even qualify for a student loan. But another thing that, as far as illegal immigrants are concerned, there are these detention centers all over the country. And some of the women are raped, and the men are beaten, and they're in places where people don't even know where these detention centers are, like Geo Group. And to save money, they don't offer health care or enough food. And you know, I think that's more of a matter of torture. And I think, you know, as far as the immigrancy issue, that's something a lot of people don't know about. And that's just something I just want to throw in there that's got to stop, these for-profit detention centers.
Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan.
Right out of the gate, I want to say that I want to codify DACA and protect Dreamers. And I have so much admiration for our senators here in Illinois who have stood so strong against Donald Trump. And we need more people like them in Congress. You know, I was in Springfield at an event, and the event was primarily immigrants, and I was having a fantastic conversation with a couple. He was a CPA and she's a neonatologist. And after a few minutes, I said to them, well, where did you immigrate from? Haiti. And this was the day after Senator Dick Durbin stood up to Donald Trump. And I said, I'm so sorry you had to hear that from our president. And they said, well, thank you for saying that. We know that there's good people like you, like Senator Durbin, who are going to fight for us. And we can't lose sight of that, of changing the people who are in the room at the decision-making tables. That is on us to do. I want our immigrants to have a clear path to citizenship. I want our Democrats to hold strong. I believe immigrants have made this beautiful mosaic of our nation, and I will stand up for them and for all of us.
And Professor Ebel, your shot at this.
So I have to say that I was a little bit disappointed in the leadership of the Democratic Party a few weeks ago, and the standing strong didn't quite come through when we had the government shut down, and we had the Republicans in a place where they were going to be forced to negotiate. Feels to me like we abandoned an opportunity there to get this resolution done for DACA and for Dreamers. I hope that I'm wrong on that. I want to say, as I look at what might be a legislative solution to this, that I do believe that walls are for cowards, and that history is unkind to those who build walls to either keep people out or hold them in. I do remember a time when the Republican Party was cheering for a president who called for a wall to be torn down. And now they are cheering for a president who is doing everything he can to build one. And I am a historian. I can't wait to write that history. As I look at what legislative solutions we might find, I think the McCain-Coons bill is not a bad one to deal with DACA and the Dreamers separate from any sort of, you know, garbage wall idea, the first-century solution to a 21st-century problem that we can create border security without this ridiculous charade. I guess we shouldn't be surprised that we're seeing from President Trump.
And Dr. Gill.
I was at a DACA march on Saturday in Champaign. There were a couple hundred people out there on a very cold, windy day to march in support of a clean DACA bill. And I don't think there's any place for compromise on this one, Charlie. I travel around the 14 counties of this district, and I talk to a lot of people, not just left-of-center people. And I think that this issue has reached a level of heartlessness that it goes beyond even everyday Republicans feel any comfort with. There might be some segment within their base that dislikes people just because their skin is brown or black, but this has gone too far. And the majority of people in America, the majority of people in Illinois 13 anyhow, recognize that these young people had promises made to them, and they have done nothing wrong by any definition of the word wrong, and this is the only home that they've ever known. And to turn our backs on them now is a travesty, a complete immoral act. And, you know, Frederick Douglass said that power concedes nothing without a demand. And I think on this one, we need to make a demand and stand by our demand because we are so right, and the majority of Americans understand that we're right.
Well, your responses have prompted another follow-up from me. They've been quite strong and full of your values. So the response, 30 seconds in the same order, starting with Eric Jones. Would you accept a government shutdown, as Republicans have stood for their values and shut down the government, over this particular issue?
So, you know, the framing of this has been that the Democrats forced the government shutdown over this issue. And I take issue with that because the Republican Party has had months to do something on this issue, to do something for the Dreamers. They've also had months to do something on the budget. Now, the most recent vote was for a short-term extension to allow the government to open for 3 weeks that Senator Durbin and Senator Duckworth and a lot of representatives, the Democratic representatives across the country, endorsed. I would have been okay with that, but we can't let this keep going.
Okay. Angel Sides.
Yeah, I mean, I think they had plenty of time to do something as well. I think, if we have to shut down the government to get something done, then that's what we need to do. But I think first and foremost, we need to resolve this because the DACA recipients have always lived here. They consider this their home. I mean, it would be like, you know, one of us having to leave the United States. So
okay, thank you. Yeah. You too would accept a shutdown. Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, your take on shutdown or not?
Yeah, I don't want a shutdown any more than anybody else. But the problem right now is that there's no trust. And there's no trust that this administration is going to move forward and protect the Dreamers. And so if that's the way, if there is no trust and this is the path that Republicans are forcing us down, then that's a path that they're going to force us down. And we have to stand up for our Dreamers.
Jonathan Eber.
Which is precisely what we should have done a couple of weeks ago. Back in 1995 and 1996, I was in the military when we shut down the government. Newt Gingrich shut down the government, I guess, because he had some dyspepsia or something like that. And then again in 1996, the same thing happened. At least in this case, there's a legitimate and just cause for this course of action. So I would absolutely support a government shutdown.
Okay, and Dr. Gill, you're the final take on this.
I think
question.
It's unanimous, yes. No one wants to see a shutdown, but ultimately, if it comes to that, yes. And I agree with John. We should have held strong a couple of weeks ago. I'm endorsed by a couple of groups that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign, the Justice Democrats and Brand New Congress, because I stand for social justice. And if we won't stand up for these young people, then you know, it makes you wonder what the heck we're all doing here, engaging in public policy debate.
This is Sound Ideas, and you're listening to 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org. On this final question, we're going to curtail the answers to meet our time commitments, so you all have the full allotment for your closing. 1 minute answers instead of 90 seconds, please, on this one, and it should not be that complex. Greg Coos of Bloomington asks you to relate what you have personally done to lower your carbon footprint. So we'll start with Angel Sides.
I actually have solar panels on my house right now, and I do drive a 2005 Honda Civic Hybrid. It's kind of junky, but I bought it just because it's a hybrid, and I do recycle. I don't know. Can't think of anything else.
All righty, Betsy Dirksen.
I do everything I can. I can tell you that.
When we bought our house, it was old and needed a lot of updating, and so everything we did was to make sure that we were being environmentally sound. So I was trying to think through my head. We put in geothermal, and that's been excellent. We put in cork floors, which is a sustainable material. We did that with anything that we put into the house. We just made sure that it was a sustainable material. We have recycled carpet, recycled plastic bottles that are our carpet. And so we tried to, on a personal level, make sure that we were walking the walk and not just talking the talk, and teaching our children that decisions matter.
Jonathan, ixnay on the Arbon Cave.
So I count to 100 when I'm showering, and when I get to 100, I'm done. That's true. My daughters are watching on Facebook. They're streaming, and they can vouch for me. So it's that. I also ride my bicycle to work, and I take public transportation. The cost bar for entry into a green lifestyle is awfully high. We haven't been able to put solar panels on the house, although I would love to do that. We haven't been able to afford a hybrid car or an electric car. That's another thing that I would love to do. But this does point up the kind of economic justice side of the green movement that I think we need to address as a society, how it is that we can get people who aren't, who are living middle class and working class lives to be involved in green and renewable energies.
David Gill, your turn for the green living question.
Great question by Greg Coos. It speaks to the issue that is of paramount importance. We've talked about a lot of things about which I'm quite passionate, but climate change is up here and everything else has to be down here, because when we fail to do this right, there's not going to be human civilization left to fight about all the other issues that we've been talking about. I personally drove a Prius for 200,000 miles. I've put three of my children into Priuses. I've put my wife into a hybrid vehicle. We recycle the giant bin. Every 2 weeks they pick it up. And my first wife passed away many years ago, but she insisted that all of our paper products be bought from a company called Seventh Generation Recycled Paper, which doesn't feel good when you're blowing your nose. But the name Seventh Generation comes from an Iroquois saying that every public policy decision, you need to consider the impact seven generations down the road. Terrific, terrifically huge issue that needs dealing with.
And you get the last crack at that.
All right. I recycle as well. We make sure we save as much energy as we can in our household. And I will tell you, from a personal standpoint, I can actually talk about what I've done in my career, too. I was just endorsed by the League of Conservation Voters for the work that I have done on the environment personally. And that's what I want to talk about. I have gone after the Bush administration for the disinformation they put out on climate change, which is one of the biggest things we've dealt with in our country. I've also gone after the Bush administration for politicization of science, for ozone NACs, on and on and on. And I understand these issues because I spent a number of years working on them, and I know that when we're dealing with energy efficiency, that is one of the greatest wastes that we have, and that's why we live in our household with, we also turn out all the lights and take short showers and have replaced our windows too.
All right.
The environment's important to me, and I've been fighting for it throughout my career.
And that answer moves us to our closing statements. We're going to go in reverse order from our opening statements, which means Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan, you may begin.
All right, thank you. And thank you again for hosting tonight. This has been fantastic. So, you know, what I want to leave you with is that I am a daughter of the 13th District. I'm a mother who's raised her family in the 13th District. I'm a student, a voter, a taxpayer, a worker, all right here in the 13th District. When you vote for me to send me to Washington, you should never have a concern about, is what she's saying really what she's going to do? Because it's the same thing I've always done. I am invested in our community and in our district because that's who I am. And I am the same Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan right here that I will be in DC fighting for all of us in the 13th and raising our voices in DC.
And reverse order means Angel Sides goes next.
I have a family member that's addicted to heroin, and they overdosed, almost killing themselves three times. And I have checked into getting rehabilitation for this family member, and they wanted to put this family member on a months-long waiting list. So my dad just said there's not much help out there. We're just going to have to brace ourselves for this family member to not be with us any longer. But instead of doing that, I got signatures, and I was compelled because I was getting signatures kind of out of desperation, just not to go crazy, I guess. And I'm angry at our system. We have 64% of our discretionary spending goes to war. We're guarding the opium fields in Afghanistan. We look the other way to the heroin labs in Tajikistan.
Your time is up. 1 minute for Eric Jones.
You know, we've talked a lot about tonight about health care, about what we want to do on health insurance, on addressing climate change, on addressing our tax issues in this country, on infrastructure investment. But we can't forget what we're facing when we go to Congress in early 2019. And Donald Trump will still be president. And he has put somebody in charge of the EPA who doesn't believe in climate change. He's put somebody in charge of the Department of Education who does not believe in public education. He's dismantling the CFPB and all the financial protections put in place following the financial crisis. And he has also called his own Department of Justice the deep state. The house is on fire in Washington, and we need firefighters, and I have been fighting fires throughout my career. I have held an administration accountable before. I spent a number of years doing congressional investigations. I understand how that work is conducted, and I am ready to go do that work on day one for the people in this district.
David Gill, your closing remarks.
In closing, I'd like to mention a couple of conversations that I had recently. A reporter called me a couple weeks ago, and he said, Dr. Gill, what do you say to the criticism from the DCCC that we need a fresh face in the district? And I told him, and I'll tell you tonight, that we've had a fresh face. I haven't run for this seat for 6 years. I came within 0.3 of 1 point of beating Rodney Davis. My message won, but for that liberal independent. And then I stepped aside so that they could run a fresh face. And I watched another fresh face in 2016. I've watched those individuals lose by 50 to 60 times what I lost by. I can't keep standing aside for fresh faces. Last week, I was in Piatt County, and a woman said to me, Dr. Gill, I love what you stand for. I love where you're at on all the issues, but I worry, are you too radical to win? And I told her, no. I said, look at the numbers. We still have real facts in this world. 0.3 of 1 point is a lot less than 18 to 20 points. And now with a two-person race, I can eliminate Rodney Davis from Washington, D.C.
Thank you. Jonathan Ebel, your last word.
So for a long time, Illinois has had the reputation as a place where ethics come to die. And this is unfair. As I've been circulating in the district, I've met lots and lots of people who are working very hard to do the right thing. What's been going on is we haven't been served well by our elected officials and the political system that put them in place, whether it's Rodney Davis or Rod Blagojevich. Now, there are two ways forward here. We can either never again elect somebody named Rodney, or we can try to bring new faces and new perspectives into the conversation. If you privilege me with this job, I will serve you faithfully. If you privilege me with this job, I will work every day to bend the power of this great nation, to bring Medicare for all to be the law of the land, to protect workers' rights, women's rights, and civil rights, and to protect the environment that is right now in peril. I ask you to please send me. Thank you.
Thank you, candidates, for participating in this live on-location edition of Sound Ideas and 13th District Congressional Candidate Forum, co-sponsored with the McLean County League of Women Voters, Illinois State University College Democrats, the ISU School of Communication, and the Historic Norma Theater. WGLT.org is where you can find this episode of Sound Ideas with help from broadcast technologist Travis Metters, events and outreach director Linda Healy, digital director Ryan Denham, chief announcer Laura Kennedy, program director Mike McCurdy, and our timekeepers Reagan Rinciuso and Becky Ropp of the League of Women Voters. I'm Charlie Schlenker. The primary is March 20th. Go vote in whatever party ballot you choose, but vote. Thanks to you for attending and listening. This is WGLT Normal, a service of Illinois State University.
Some of the artists that you heard that were most important to you then, and have you met some of them?
Yeah, well, my very favorite artist on Blue Note was Wayne Shorter, who I re-signed. That was one of the first things I did, was brought him back to Blue Note. And so he's such a vibrant artist who really, in terms of having impact on composition and how people played and the nature of the musical conversation, his groups have always kind of been on the forefront of redefining the interplay.
And on this new box set that extends the Blue Note Review, Peace, Love, and Fishing, yes. You've got a track there from Wayne Shorter,
Wayne's Quartet.
Zero yeah. Gravity.
It's number 913 or something like that.
Yeah, I forgot about the 913 there on the end. That's right.
You know why I picked that? Well, it's my birthday, 9th September the 13th, but it was also Bruce Lundvall's birthday.
Oh, and, good.
And at that time, it was right after Bruce passed. There's a nod to Bruce, and also that the torch was passed to someone with the same birthday and hopefully the same outlook on music.
The box set is called Peace, Love, and Fishing. Would you like to break down those three things?
Well, peace and love is pretty clear, right?
Yeah.
The fishing part of it, you cast your line into some dark waters and you don't know if you're going to pull up garbage or you're going to catch a beautiful trout. And that's kind of like what improvising music is. You just jump. Man, you jump into the unknown, and sometimes something amazing happens, and you have to be willing to fall on your face. And if you fall on your face, you do what Miles Davis used to do, and you make a motif out of that and take it in a new direction.